Welcome to Babel Undone, a podcast created by Premier in partnership with Archbishop Joseph D'Souza and the Good Shepherd Church of India. Bishop D'Souza is a renowned Christian intellectual and civil rights activist from India who leads the Good Shepherd movement and the All India Christian Council. And I'm Johnny Moore, an American evangelical who serves as the president of the Congress of Christian Leaders and JDA worldwide. We live in an interconnected world where the questions are complex. So on every episode of Babel Undone, Bishop D'Souza and I aim to bring the global church together in conversation about an important issue facing everyone. And we do it from different perspectives. Bishop comes from the East and I come from the West. So naturally, we meet in London. So today we're talking about how Iran, China, and others hijack the United Nations and many of the organizations that exist solely for the purpose of protecting human rights. And we're doing it just days after the Islamic Republic of Iran committed an unprecedented attack on the state of Israel, which has shocked the entire world, except those who were paying the closest attention. So we're going to go deep on this topic. It may be a bit technical. But if you care about human rights and religious freedom, as all Christians should, this is information you need to know, and you need to know it now. And Bishop, we have a world expert to guide us through it.
And that's Richard Goldberg, who is a senior advisor at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a nonpartisan research institute that focuses on national security and foreign policy in the U.S. and around the world. He has served on the White House National Security Council as chief of staff to the governor of Illinois and a lot of other key positions.
And Richard joins us now. Richard, I know very, very few people that have as wide sweeping of a view of all the different facets of what we've been seeing in the Middle East since October 7th, and then also just a few days ago as the Islamic Republic of Iran really took an unprecedented action, sent hundreds of projectiles, ballistic missiles, drones into Israel. Thank God with the help of the United States and Arab allies, that was a disastrous failure by the Islamic Republic. It was a massive, massive success for the state of Israel and its allies. But just because Israel survived this terrible attack doesn't make it any less serious. And so I'm just curious right out of the gate here how you see the current situation. What are facets of this that people aren't paying enough attention to, and what's next?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of framing this. The success of the missile defenses of Israel, combined with the active support in the air by the U.S. military, in fact, the British military, surprisingly as well, playing a role here, all of that needs to be commended. It needs to be reaffirmed that we're going to invest in these solutions and systems, keep working for resupply. That was a lot of interceptors used Saturday night. There's going to need to be more on the way. These are expensive systems. And sort of a reaffirmation of our joint cooperation with Israel for Israel's defense, knowing that it is part of the puzzle to deter Israeli adversaries, who are our adversaries, especially when you're talking about the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's the good news. The bad news is, as you just said, the supreme leader in Iran made a calculation that he could launch an unprecedented strategic attack on Israel. 120 ballistic missiles alone, plus the cruise missiles, plus the drones. Ballistic missiles are not homemade rockets like we were used to seeing out of Gaza for so many years that the Iron Dome was dealing with. These are massive weapons that are intended to inflict a lot of damage and a lot of casualties. And they are nuclear capable to one day potentially carry a nuclear warhead. And they are working in Iran towards longer and longer range missiles so that it doesn't just hit Israel or Eastern Europe, but it hits London or it hits Washington, D.C. And that we know they are working towards that intercontinental ballistic missile capability. And so the idea that the Supreme Leader thought he could launch that kind of attack, whether it got through or it doesn't get through Israel's missile defenses, and face no consequences, no costs, means that he made a calculation, not a miscalculation. It's only a miscalculation if he does something and pays a tremendous cost, an unexpected cost for doing it, and doesn't want to do it again or doesn't want to escalate from here being a new baseline. And I fear we're not doing any sort of self-assessment, self-reflection of what brought us to that mindset in Tehran and what needs to change going forward to prevent that from happening ever again. And so what is the first question I just asked? What's the answer to that? Well, you have two things going on in the world right now: accommodationist policies of Iran, sanctions relief, whether that's direct from the United States, opening up spigots of cash, whether that's multilateral, the British government refusing to trigger the snapback of UN sanctions as well with France and Germany, other nations holding back for fear of offending or escalating with the Iranians, the British government refusing to this day to prescribe the IRGC as a terrorist organization, same for the EU, same for Canada. All of these things going on in front of the Iranians, where it's not a debate until Saturday night of should the Israeli military respond, oh no, that could escalate. We don't want to see that happen, which is the message now being heard from the West. It was, should we cut off this $10 billion for Iran? No, they might escalate. Well, should we just bring back Security Council sanctions on Iran as they're accelerating their nuclear program? No. That might force them to escalate. So every potential consequence, every form of coercion, of pressure, of isolation that has been contemplated over the last 3 years and more for our European allies has been rejected as a potential path to escalation. You take that mindset and you combine it with the last several weeks and months of political warfare against Israel, isolation of Israel, threats to cut off support and military aid to Israel, as we've seen pressure on the Sunak government in London. You've seen pressure increase from President Biden. You actually saw the Canadians do it. Justin Trudeau actually cutting off arms sale components to Israel in the middle of a war. You see Israel being held back by the United States from countering nonstop missile attack from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon for fear of escalation into a regional war. The acceptance of the Houthis in Yemen, another Iranian client, lobbing daily missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, drones into the Red Sea at international shipping vessels and the US Navy. And that just becomes normal. It's just a day in the Red Sea now. And so, why wouldn't you, in this complete picture, calculate in your mind, if you're the Supreme Leader, let's just take it one step forward.
So,
120 ballistic missiles, and that's now what all that is. That's just Saturday night in the Middle East going forward. It's not an escalation. That's just Saturday night. The next step will be escalation. This is the new normal. We can't allow that to happen.
but am I hearing you correctly that I think what you just said a few minutes ago, that if you're the average American walking around Washington, D.C., or, the average Brit walking that I rode together with on the tube to come to the studio this morning. You're saying that the takeaway that we should take away from what happened this last weekend when Iran attacked Israel is that Iran realistically could decide to send ballistic missiles not just at our ally Israel, but at London, at Washington. I mean, this is you're saying this is the rational conclusion why people in the Congress and Parliament here ought to be taking more action. Is that hyperbole, or is it theory, or there's something more to it?
Well, that's the trajectory of their missile program and the ranges of their missiles. So right now, you might not care in London about the Iranian missile program because their missiles can't reach London. But at some point, they will. They will get there. You may not care about the Iranian missile program in Washington, D.C., other than the threat to U.S. forces and bases in the Middle East and the threat to Israel. At some point, they will get there. The North Koreans got there. This is all based on North Korean technology that the Iranians are using. So all I'm saying is If you don't think this is a local issue at this point, after the Red Sea has been under constant attack, shipping to Europe under constant attack, instability in the Middle East causing all kinds of instability around the world, all because of Iran, and you don't think what you just saw on Saturday night is something that is a potential threat one day to you, if this regime, this radical terror sponsoring regime, which we know conducts operations in Britain, a stabbing attack, which we still don't have the full details on who was behind it, in London against an Iran international reporter, terror plots in France over the years, Hezbollah assets throughout the world. All this, you don't think that if this regime gets nuclear weapons and has the missiles to project its power to London or to Washington, that the game doesn't completely change in Iran's favor? I'm not saying you're going to have missiles raining down on London. It could happen, but you can't ignore that threat once you're in range from a regime like this. But look at how deterred London is. We're picking on London right now, but any of these Western countries, look how deterred London is right now from putting the IRGC on a terror list after a stabbing attack, which seems pretty obviously IRGC, and we don't have the full evidence.
Why
We've
don't
had
you?
other plots,
Sorry,
operations. Yeah, go
sorry
ahead.
to interrupt, but I think we use the term like IRGC because some of us pay attention to human rights and pay attention to what's happening in Israel and national security and all of these things. I mean, Bishop D'Souza and I work on religious freedom and human rights all the time, so we're very familiar with the IRGC. And but a lot of people listening to us may not be. The Christian pastors who might pray for Israel this summer, or pray for the persecuted Christian church in Iran, or the local political leader, not the parliamentarian or something. So what exactly is the IRGC? And then let's move into how the international system is or is not helping all this.
The basic way, layman's terms of the IRGC is this is a paramilitary organization, part of the Iranian government, signed to be the guardians of the Islamic Revolution, split into various pillars for assigned responsibilities. And those responsibilities are among the most horrific illicit activities that Iran is involved in, that Tehran directs. So you have the Quds Force. Of this Revolutionary Guard Corps. IRGC, by the way, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, called the Revolutionary Guards for short. The IRGC is an acronym. Quds Force is conducting terror operations throughout the Middle East. They are coordinating with Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza, Islamic Jihad in Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, with Bashar Assad in Syria, with the militias you've seen attack US forces in Iraq and Syria, in cells in the West Bank as well, with the Houthis in Yemen, arming them, training them, coordinating with them, creating a ring of fire, as the Supreme Leader calls it, around Israel, but always chanting death to America, death to Israel, looking for opportunities to attack America and its democratic allies. It has a branch that does foreign operations, and we've seen them coordinate foreign attacks and terror plots and assassination plots. We have plots active today to kill former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former National Security Advisor John Bolton and other U.S. officials. Internally in the regime, you have a branch that's all about internal repression and ensuring that while it might, be too much in the stomach for a regular Iranian policeman to stand in the street and shoot a woman who is standing up for her rights, to shoot a Christian who wants to simply pray the way that they want to pray, that might not be something that a regular Iranian policeman has the stomach to do because it's horrific. So they bring in elements of the guard to do it for them because these are hardened ideologues that are committed to preserving the Supreme Leader's vision, the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So this is a really, really, really bad organization. We have designated it as a terrorist organization in the United States because it conducts itself as a terror group. And many of us urge the British government to follow suit. The British government has not wanted to. There's documented evidence you can see in the Jewish Chronicle of London. They've done, I think, some of the best exposés on the IRGC forces and elements and networks that have penetrated Great Britain in various mosque organizations, university settings. People are literally having seminars, webinars, Zooms with IRGC officials being radicalized inside Great Britain, documented. Not illegal, because they're not a terrorist organization prescribed by the United Kingdom the way that Hamas and Hezbollah are. That needs to happen. And now we've seen a stabbing attack against one of the Iranian dissident news channels that's based in London, Iran International, one of the anchors. The people fled immediately out of the airport, out of the country. What does that sound like to you? And yet, still no movement here. So, this is like a basic element of you want to say that you support Israel. You want to say you're opposed to Iran. You want to say you're for national security, but you're afraid to even put this organization on a terror list to give law enforcement more tools to protect your own citizens. Why? Because you're afraid of Iranian escalation? My goodness. Why should Iran fear going across the nuclear threshold or building longer range missiles when you won't even do basic things to protect your own citizens?
Richard, how have they managed to win this propaganda war, the Iranians, and influence the UN and everybody else so much that they are not being called to task for these things?
Well, it's a great question. Some of this has to do with, in my view, the partnership, the bridge that the Iranians crossed many years ago. Remember, Iran is a Shia theocracy. Hamas is a Sunni terrorist organization. It doesn't actually make sense on paper for the two to be partners, for one to be the sponsor of the other. But in fact, that is the state of affairs. Qatar is another country that is a sponsor of Hamas and closely coordinates with Iran. Qatar is a sponsor of a lot of Sunni radical causes. They were caught red-handed financing elements of Al-Qaeda and of ISIS in the 2010s in Syria and Iraq, obviously longtime patrons of Hamas. What the Iranians are able to do by crossing over and partnering with the Qataris, Hamas, and the larger Muslim Brotherhood network is use their own information operations combined with major disinformation infrastructure that has been built over many years across the Muslim Brotherhood as well. By the way, embedded in the UN system in various ways, because you have UN agencies that are wholly controlled and subject to the disinformation of Hamas in Gaza, of Iranian-backed forces, of Iran and Qatar. You have Al Jazeera, which obviously acts as a major source of propaganda and disinformation for both Iran and for Hamas. And so if you have UN agencies operating on the ground in Gaza, they're all collaborating with Hamas. They're all working with Al Jazeera, Hamas, et cetera, all these different nodes of disinformation. And in many cases, they have, they're comprised, their employees are Hamas operatives. We've seen that with UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, that was caught red-handed with members who committed crimes on October 7th. Half or at least of all their employees touch Hamas in some way, a membership or in the family. And you see that every time the Israelis are trying to do something to isolate UNRWA or have a non-UNRWA, non-Hamas way of distributing food in Gaza, it's these UN organizations there that throw up their, oh, you can't do that. You're starving the people now. You're not using Hamas. You're not using UNRWA. So that means that Israel is now responsible for starving the people. Really? That's the definition of starving the people, is saying we need a non-Hamas distribution network for aid. And then you have UN agencies that have been built over time by adversaries of the United States. And now this is where you zoom out and you say, okay, Iran can do so much, the Muslim Brotherhood can do so much, but systematically inside the UN system, dating back to really the Cold War era, but now re sort of revitalized, if you will, in the new Cold War era of the United States versus China and Russia, and Iran being that third part of that axis that we have to remember. These organizations use UN agencies, these countries use UN agencies to advance their agendas, to undermine the United States. And if undermining Israel undermines the United States, then that's to their advantage.
Can you give us some
There's
examples?
examples. We can give you examples.
Yeah, because this matters a lot to us. I mean, as Christians, I mean, we spend a ton of time in this podcast studio and through our respective ministries and advocacy talking about religious freedom around the world and human rights around the world. And, you know, these organizations, you know, the UN Human Rights Commission and the Council on Human Rights and the, you know, all these women's organizations. It just the list goes on and on. And like we kind of want to hold out hope that, you know, they'll actually protect human rights or women or, you know, or religious freedom. And it seems like there's some pretty bad examples of that, not only of that not happening, but it's almost like the inmates have taken over the asylum.
So where China, Russia, and Iran have figured out the game is that any UN agency that sort of operates like Model UN and, you know, one country, one vote, everybody's equal, anybody can run for president, anybody can serve on the board, nobody, you know, gets to muscle around agendas. They can go in, run for leadership on secret ballot elections oftentimes, serve on governance committees, the board of directors, even lead the organizations, start directing budget in some of these organizations if they win elections, and use their economic coercive power against other members to orchestrate votes in their favor and to undermine the United States. The Human Rights Council is obviously the most in-your-face example of where this happens. There are other agencies as well that are less known, that aren't in that space. There's technical organizations, standards-making organizations for technology, telecommunications, the Food and Agriculture Organization, where China continues to lead that agency. There are strategic reasons why China wants to lead certain agencies for their Belt and Road Initiative, for their geopolitical agendas. There are reasons why Russia wants to make hay in certain agencies, like in the arms control areas, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, because they want to whitewash their own sins in the use of chemical weapons, what Bashar Assad has done in Syria, what they've done with nerve agents against dissidents. They want to create chaos as far as distracting the world from what Iran is doing in their nuclear program, Iran being a close ally as well. They do that in the IAEA. But in the Human Rights Council, it's a body elected directly from the General Assembly on secret ballot voting, regional blocks. China can go up to any country, look over their shoulder and say, you're voting China, right? And win election time after time onto the Human Rights Council. And when they get there, they can look around and say, okay, we're never going to allow a resolution that condemns China to pass. We're never going to allow resolutions that condemn most of our allies if they come to us saying, help us stop this resolution against you fill in the blank of human rights abuser. And China will say, okay, we're going to help you with this. We're going to threaten all the other people on the council. They can't vote for this. They'll have a diplomatic problem with us. We'll have a trade problem with us. And remember, especially in the third world, but not only, China has built up massive coercive economic leverage through horrible debt deals in Africa and Latin America and elsewhere. So they can go and bully countries in their own backyard. Obviously, in the Asia Pacific, they can go bully countries for other reasons, and they win these votes. Now, the detractors of Israel have also burrowed into this system to say, this is great. We can just go after Israel on a daily basis, make Israel the most condemned country in the world in the Human Rights Council, while never condemning China, up until the war in Ukraine, never condemning or doing anything to Russia, leaving North Korea alone, you know, leaving Cuba alone for sure. Cuba figured this system out a long time ago during the Cold War. And if America wants to try to do something, we'll try to block it. And so you sort of have to step back. This is the organization that at the top of their lungs, I mean, all kinds of experts hired. They call them special rapporteurs who investigate things, report back. With respect to Israel and the Palestinians, they have hired the most virulent anti-Semites, documented, not being hyperbolic. that say the worst things, worst accusations, no basis for them. They are propaganda artists to delegitimize Israel, but they are the UN talking. They are the UN experts talking. They have a commission of inquiry into Israel to continue to look into whether Israel is committing apartheid. You know, anything they can do to delegitimize Israel. And then the United States is left with the question of a policy perspective, and other countries as well, Great Britain as well. Should we participate in this? Is this a charade? There is an argument that is put forward. If we don't show up, they simply own the forum, they do whatever they want, and there's no dissent. The alternative argument, of course, is that there's already going to be a circus. They're already going to get their way. And this is legitimizing something called the Human Rights Council, which is really the Human Rights Abuse Council. And we shouldn't be putting our money and our political participation in there. We should take our marbles and go somewhere else together of countries that actually stand for human rights. That's actually a human rights council that actually focuses on the worst human rights abusers on earth of non-free states, not democracies. We don't do that. We should do that. But, you know, this bleeds into other agencies. You talk about UN Women, you know, where Iran could rise to lead an organization. We have disarmament conferences where Iran or North Korea can lead the conference. I mean, this is an upside down world at the United Nations. It truly is. And you saw, you know, over time, we've ebbed and flowed on how we approach our UN strategy from the United States. Nikki Haley was pretty, you know, beloved for really being a bomb thrower and taking it to detractors of Israel, detractors of the United States. Donald Trump decided to condition aid to organizations, withdraw from organizations if he wasn't getting his way. Some agencies that can work. The U.S. historically is 25% of the UN's budget. And that typically translates into organizations where there is a voluntary contribution reliance. That is to say, not just an earmark from the total UN budget. Over and above the UN's budget, countries who are members of an organization pledge dues and give money as well. Even in those organizations, the US usually is 25% the largest donor. If you have a governance structure, an election structure for the board, for the leadership, and major financial influence from the United States, stands to reason if we actually did what China does and have intense diplomacy, intense conversations with allies, went through the list of everybody voting and says, you're with us or you're against us, in an organization that may not be in the top of your mind, World Health Organization, nobody cares about it until there's a pandemic and there's a cover-up of where a major virus came from, you know, and by the way, another organization, of all the things in the world going on in health, Israel has, like the Human Rights Council, a standing agenda item for the World Health Assembly to be condemned every year, by the way. The emergency executive board of the World Health Organization after October 7th didn't convene to condemn Hamas for using hospitals as human shields or attacking Israeli hospitals directly or hostage taking or all the horrible things that were done on October 7th. They convened as an executive council, which includes North Korea now, by the way, to condemn Israel.
Wow.
And the United States didn't vote no. So, you know, a lot of stuff happening in these UN organizations that are really bad. And in some cases, we legitimize it, we fund it. In some cases, it's on autopilot, and we got to figure out how to destroy it, quite frankly, and rebuild it if it's possible.
Is that possible? Can this be fixed or not fixed?
So I think one of the best policy solutions that is controversial, and it's hard to get through because you have to think through the consequences of this policy, but I think it's the right policy, is moving from an assessed contribution model in the UN to an all-voluntary contribution model. Not my original idea. I think John Bolton, former Ambassador Bolton, had advocated for this even when he was at the UN. And that is to say, if there's an organization that's fixed, it's rigged. Like the process doesn't make sense. The governance doesn't make sense. We can't, we're giving all this money through the UN and we can't get what we want. China can run the table here. Detractors of Israel can run the table. We can whitewash a genocide in Xinjiang, but spend all day on apartheid accusations against Israel. We should pick up sticks and leave. And make sure everyone knows this is not legitimate. We don't believe in this. It's not real. And work with our allies and push our allies to come with us to something else. Well, if there are areas that are doing good work, working with children in sub-Saharan Africa, doing things that no one else is going to do, and we have at least some oversight of the organization and an ability to influence for just good governance of the organization, we can choose to fund it. We'll write the check. But nobody's owed money. We're not obligated to give money, and certainly not to the main core budget that is used and abused by China, Russia, Iran, and our detractors.
Will the U.S. ever come to the place where they decide, this is the system post Second World War was made to fit a certain context and purpose. The UN is no more fit for purpose. We have to think. Will the U.S. ever come to that place?
It's very difficult to imagine the diplomatic inertia that surrounds it from all of our allies. The true belief in multilateralism that exists within the diplomatic corps, and I'm not attacking it at a fundamental core. From an idealistic perspective, it's very good. It sounds good. It should be good. If we were actually working together to do good and to change and achieve reforms and put the screws to all countries that stand in the way of that. If you could actually come together and say, US, United Kingdom, G7, whatever list you want to come with, and say, okay, here's all of our combined leverage over the following 100 countries that continue to vote against us and work against us and help China and Russia and Iran on a daily basis in these 12 organizations and the General Assembly. What if we went to them all and said, this game is done. This isn't just fun Model UN business. You are hurting the United States. You're hurting all Western democracies. You're undermining human rights, and you're helping those that are trying to oppress the weak. And we're not going to stand for it. And that means financial assistance, foreign assistance, military assistance, trade arrangements, all that. You get to choose. We like you, but you're not really acting like somebody that deserves all of our support. Would that change their vote in New York or Geneva or wherever the vote? I think it would for a lot. I think we never really tried something like that. That's a huge undertaking. And a lot of Europeans don't want to pursue that. It's too uncomfortable. They like their cocktail parties. Cocktail parties are nice. It'd be nice to everybody at a cocktail party.
Last question. There is another way this changes, and that is if Iran changes, if China changes. I mean, I think, a lot of times in this conversation, Bishop D'Souza and I are always sort of distinguishing between the Islamic Republic versus the people of Iran,
right,
or between the Chinese people versus the CCP. And part of that is, as an evangelical, like I there are a lot of evangelicals in Iran. There are a lot of evangelicals in China, and they don't support. Well, in fact, I happen to know a lot of evangelicals in Iran who were praying against the success of those missiles the other day, who pray every day for the peace of Jerusalem. So when you look across the landscape, how do you think about the Iranian people versus the regime that tyrannizes them, the Chinese people versus the Communist Party, which wants to inflict a genocide in Xinjiang and repress other religious people? I should also add, Rich, one of the sort of strange things to me, particularly here in Europe, is I've observed some of these anti-Israel protests, and it's like there's also these sort of Marxist communist things. It seems like they're being organized by political ideologues who aren't who aren't the first people that you would think that would support Hamas. So what about the people versus these regimes?
One of the missing elements of the so-called maximum pressure campaign was an overt sidekick, which I would call maximum support. Maximum pressure doesn't work alone. You have to have maximum support for the people of Iran as well. And that's true in all closed societies where we are facing an adversary and potential threat. The people are your greatest asset, and it's true in Iran. Now, there's a lot of people who are skeptical of that in the United States today. They're skeptical of that because they hear people say things like what you heard before the invasion of Iraq, They hear, you know, they're going to celebrate us in the streets. It's going to be a magical day. The people of Iraq are going to have a magical democracy. Everything's going to be great. And so everybody thinks in the context of what they saw happen in Iraq post-invasion, and they apply it everywhere else in the world where we want to promote human rights, help people become people who can defend their own rights, pray that they the way they want, say the things they want, organize freely the way we do in America. And unfortunately, we need to get back to the model of Ronald Reagan and the Soviet Union and have a new paradigm for this and a new way of talking about it. That's not about breaking societies and invading societies and nation building, but it's talking about core principles of human dignity and supporting human aspirations, individuality, freedoms for all peoples, because that is our core thesis as a nation and should be for our allies as well. And then the question is, well, what do you do to accomplish that? What do you do to achieve that? Is that just a rhetorical device? Or are there tangible things you can do to help people on the ground achieve their own individual aspirations? And I think that there are. We did it during the Soviet era. We did it in covert ways. We worked with church groups to do it as well. We worked with the Catholic Church to do it and others. Think of the Solidarity Movement. We're in a 21st century environment now. So we're not creating printing presses. We're looking at secure communications and access to communications and organizing tools. We have cyber capabilities we didn't have in the 20th century. How can they be applied creatively to help people? These are the things that I think, but yes, at a basic level, we also need to say it out loud. We also need to say it every day. We support the people of Iran. We support the people of China. We want to see them have the basic freedoms we have one day. And that we believe in our hearts that one day their despots, their dictators, their oppressors will end like all oppressors before them.
And we do. We say it again here. And we thank you, Richard Goldberg, for joining us.
Thank you.
Bishop, on one level, I'm just like totally flabbergasted that all of our democracies are pouring all of this taxpayer money into this system, which seems to be totally taken over by the bad guys. I mean, it's hard to not be depressed hearing that. And yet, on the same token, I'm reminded that the power of democracy is that when the people are fed up, things change. I guess we just need to pray that the people
change.
People change.
What was meant to govern the world properly has now been infiltrated and taken over by bad actors, especially the UN Human Rights Commission. It's very sad. Those who do not allow for human rights are becoming the major players. And the countries that have some semblance of human rights are marginalized. So the UN, I don't know what you think. The UN was created for a purpose and a context. And rightly, nations like India and all are saying, this is a new century, the new time. There needs to be change and reform in the UN. I think that has to come.
Yeah, and this may be an unusual topic, for some of our regular listeners, but it's a righteous topic because as Christians, we care about justice, and some of the great injustices in the world are taking place in organizations that exist in order to preserve them. And each of us, every single one of you listening to this conversation, have an opportunity to make a difference. Pray and act, because the status quo can't continue.
And don't take democracy for granted.
Amen.
Defend it.
Amen.
Thank you for joining us today for Babel Undone. If this conversation had you thinking, then why don't you share it with someone else? For more episodes of Babel Undone or other amazing content that helps Christians live out their faith, you should head over to premier.plus. That's Premier, P-R-E-M-I-E-R, for the Americans listening in, .plus.